playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. The Irish women's hockey team made history on Thursday night, roaring into the semi-finals of the World Cup for the very first time with a 3-1 penalty shootout victory over India. A fantastic achievement for an amateur side. RTE's Ray Kennedy was in London, soaking up the atmosphere with the players' families and, of course, the fans.
I'm just so thrilled for them. They deserve every minute of it.
And they really controlled all of the game. I mean, they did deserve it. There was never a doubt in your mind, I imagine.
Oh, there was sometimes, but anyway, they came through in the end. Fair dues. They deserve it so much.
Will you be staying on for the semi-final?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what do you think of the match?
Yeah, it was unreal. I think they're the best team here, to be honest. They've only team that have come out and done it, so yeah.
And your prediction for the semi-final?
Ireland are winning it! Ireland are winning it!
Unbelievable, yeah, it's a fantastic result. The girls have worked incredibly hard. This tournament has been the result of a lifetime of dedication, so now they're going to get a lifetime of happiness and a lifetime of memories from it. So they're amazing. We're so proud of them. My sister is Anna O'Flanagan. She's just played brilliantly all tournament, but the girls have just performed unbelievably as a team. It's fantastic.
It was an absolutely wonderful game. Too close for comfort, you know. Almost gave me a coronary on several occasions, but it was a wonderful win for Ireland. They're fighting way above their weight, and as I say, it may not be over yet. Who knows?
Tell us about the story and how Chloe got here.
Well, obviously in primary school, and she went on and played in secondary school, but, you know, she joined Hermes at a very young age, was lucky to experience hockey at a high level, but it just gave her the motivation to want to go on, and she loves team sport, and she's a team player, you know. Hockey is the 16 girls, and in fact, it's not only that, it's the 6 or 7 girls who didn't make it as well. They put every bit as much effort into the whole thing, and it's just wonderful, a fantastic culmination, and it's a great day for Irish hockey.
So, fingers crossed, and all eyes on RT television this afternoon for the match against Spain. Well, you know what they say, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And so it was that Sonia O'Sullivan's 16-year-old daughter Sophie won a silver medal in the 800 metres at the European Under-18 Championships last Saturday. The proud mammy was Ray Darcy's guest on Tuesday.
It's going to be Kelly Hodgkinson. Another gold medal for Britain. O'Sullivan gets the silver.
He's very unemotional there. He's not connected in any way to it. You were, though. You were there. You were running every step with your daughter, Sophie. Yes, and then, that which was lovely. Talk to me about you presenting her with the medal. Was that planned? Were you there to present medals, or there to support Sophie? Or
no, I was just there purely to be there. You know, and you know, with Sophie, it was her first time running internationally, first time on the Irish team, and I was a little bit afraid. You know, what if she felt alone or something, or maybe she didn't make it to the final, and then she'd have a whole day there by herself. What would she do? But there was no fear of that. You know, I mean, she made great friends, and I hardly saw her. You know, I'd go out of my way to pop in and see what was going on, and you know, you'd get 2 minutes, you know, like any mother and daughter, I suppose, at that age, because she was just having such a great time with all the other girls on the team.
And you had to hide because Sophie didn't know that you were going to present her with the medal.
Well, I didn't want her to know.
Right.
I didn't want to tell her because, you know, I didn't want her to be telling me off. You
all
know,
right.
telling me, she often says to me, it's not about you, you know. So I didn't want it to be about me. So, you know, I really wanted to just be a bit of a surprise.
Well, it was about the two of you, I suppose.
It was, yeah. And it was really good fun. And
lovely moment.
Yeah, it was really, really nice.
Sonia O'Sullivan with Ray Darcy on Tuesday. And what about the hurling? People are still talking about John Milan's commentary for the Limerick Cork game last Sunday.
Oh, here we go. It's squeaky bum time, as I like to call it. We're back to a 2-point game.
With a minute left, the gap's down to a point.
Oh, Porrick, I just love this game. I love this game. Galan cut the ball to Ubaldo. Peter Casey, he was caught. He couldn't pick it up. He got it back, retreated to Shane Downing. Shane Downing gets his third score. We're back to a point.
Line ball to Cork.
Oh, what have we got left in the clock? Well, we're probably 2 or 3 minutes. You wouldn't rule out a draw here.
Well, as you know, Limerick eventually powered past Cork in extra time. All-Ireland Camogie winner Anna Geary and former Galway and Dublin hurler Niall Corcoran were euphoric, as was Miriam O'Callaghan.
Oh my God, my heart rate is elevated still after it. It was just, it had everything. You know, when people talk about the GAA and why it's important, about the passion and the hits and the intensity and the scores. And there was 130 scores between those two games. That says enough. I mean, and what I loved, and I have to call out now, Tomasa Shane, Aidan Mahoney, they were out on Twitter over the weekend. They were saying, like, hurling is the best game in the world. And for two footballers and proud footballers, won a lot with Kerry to say that. I just thought it was. It was incredible stuff. And that is what the GAA is all about. And fundamentally, it's about the sport and the players. And they delivered on the biggest stage with the highest pressure. And it was just exceptional to watch.
It was incredible. Niall, as a former brilliant player yourself, it was just an amazing weekend, wasn't it?
Oh, look, it was just what hasn't been said about it. It was just one of those weekends. You know, I was in there Saturday and then you're in there Sunday and you're thinking it couldn't possibly be as good. Yeah. And it was actually better. And I like hit the nail on the head. It's just like the whole ethos of the GAA. It's but the hurling. And I suppose the hurling people, just what the whole occasion brought, I think it was just, look, fantastic. And look forward again next weekend with Galway and Clare.
My mum is from Limerick and my dad is obviously from Cork. So that for me has been the main rivalry growing up down to the years. And I wasn't even Cork Kerry football or Cork, it was Cork Limerick. So my mum couldn't even form sentences. I know she's probably listening now because she has the radio in the kitchen. She couldn't form sentences yesterday. She was so excited. You know, because it's 45 years Limerick are waiting. And I think even how composed the players were afterwards, you know, they're aware that they've been in this position before, and the last time they were in All-Ireland final didn't have the best memories.
Anna Geary. So Limerick are through to the All-Ireland hurling final, and they'll find out who they'll play when Galway and Clare face off again in a replay at Semple Stadium tomorrow. And let's not even get into the football Super 8s. Over on second captains, Owen McDevitt was checking out comedian Tommy Tiernan's sporting glories, but first off he got the fan worship stuff out of the way.
The Tommy Tiernan Show. I've got to say, I'm a massive fan.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I think part of the reason is it would be my idea of hell. just that absolute lack of comfort, not having a clue who's coming out, often trying to work out who this person is as you're having the conversation. What is the appeal of it to you? What do you get out of this program?
I kept thinking in terms of stand-up. So you get a stand-up routine together and you know it, and you kind of, you do it night after night, and there are small changes and you're always trying to push it forward, but it's essentially the same and you work the same show for 18 months maybe. So what you're doing in a way is you're repeating something that you once thought of. You still have to perform it to new people, but it's kind of an act of repetition, so it is more in common with the theatre. And I loved David Letterman, and I thought the way he was able to be off the cuff funny with guests was a sign of a true comedian. And the fact that he was doing it in front of such a large audience as well meant that his jokes weren't wasted, his talent wasn't hidden. And I just got the idea one night for the show, and I thought that I'm often able to be funny in an interview situation. I thought, wouldn't it be great that becomes the arena you play with then, as opposed to the actory repetition. There's a great quote at one time which says, a comedian is an actor pretending to be a comedian. And I thought that maybe the chat show format would be a better way of playing with that, you know. I suggested the idea to Dan Healy in 2FM that we do four live ones during the summer. He said, yep. And then we went from that to TV, and it all happened quite smartly and rapidly. So, and I wanted to quit it actually after the pilot. I said to the producer, David Parr, I'm not doing this anymore. It's too stressful. I just, it's not what I thought it was going to be, and I'm done with it. And he took me for a slice of pecan pie in the Gourmet Tart in Salt Hill in Galway.
There's a nice plug.
Well-known restorative qualities.
And by the end of it, I said, okay.
What a slice of pie.
Yeah, did I do it again.
How did he talk you around?
I guess I just told him I thought it was awful, and I didn't think that it worked. And he was saying, look, it did. And I came round to his point of view, I suppose. And I said, yeah, okay, I'll try it again. And we did. So that's what it was. It's very stressful because you can't prepare.
Yeah.
It's the decision to put yourself through that and the worry that you won't have anything to say.
Does that stress hit you when you wake up that morning?
It happens months before the show begins. Maybe that's the price you have to pay.
Well, in case you didn't know already, Tommy Tiernan grew up in Navan, County Meath, and Owen wondered what sports he played as a youngster.
I played a lot of tennis, a lot of football.
Gaelic football?
Gaelic and soccer. And then around the age of 12 or 13, apart from school soccer, I played nothing but pool. I was one of the best underage pool players coming out of Fitzsimons Bar and the Roundo. In Navan. So back then, I was part of the generation that saw the transition from 10 pence a game to 20 pence a game.
Wow. That was... I mean, just like crazy times, you know?
You know, and a transition that in a lot of social commentary is ignored.
You're bringing it back, though.
But it was, these were big moments in Navan. They, overnight, all the slots were changed.
You were given no choice. You came in the following day, that's it.
Two tens don't do.
You can take it or you can leave it, boys.
So I used to rob money out of my mother's purse and I'd go down to the bar. I'd try and play after school if I could. I once played on the Round O men's team when I was about 15. And the standard of pool in Navan was high. There's the Rocker came from there, one of the legendary North Leinster pool players. Maltese Joe Barbara, the world pool champion, came to Navan and I played him in an exhibition match.
What?
Yeah, Maltese Joe Barbara. This is the English, now, it's not the American one where it's all kind of Filipinos and Germans. This was proper pub pool, you know. And he came and he was playing a fella from Navan for 10 grand back in 84. 10 grand, 1984. And as part of his kind of visit to the town, he gave an exhibition match and I gave him a game.
How'd you get on?
Oh, he let me win. Like, I played one amazing shot. Well, he let me win. So pool was my thing, really. I think stand-up has a lot in common with sport. It's performance-based. You're only as good as your last game. Success in the previous one doesn't guarantee success in the next one. You get into rhythms. You might get 3 months where everything's going grand and 3 months where it's hard. They say, one of these staff-out quotes that come out every now and again, if you can do as an adult what you did as a child, it's a good chance of being happy at your work. So I think what I'm doing now professionally, it's quite similar to kind of stuff I was interested in.
Comedian Tommy Tiernan heard on Second Captains. Emma Vicvahuna, who suffers from terminal cervical cancer, was interviewed by Miriam O'Callaghan this week. Like Tommy Tiernan, stand-up comedy is also her thing.
I gather, Emma, you're doing a stand-up comedy gig this weekend. Is it always on your bucket list? And have you any lines prepared?
Oh, gosh. I won't be sagging Fine Gael. I'm giving them a day off. So if they want to come to the show, they're welcome. I've put them through enough hoops. They're on the summer vacation. So a few people have said I'm funny and that, and I said, feck it, it's for a good cause. It's a garden of remembrance for the victims and the families of cervical cancer, so we can go and just catch up and just somewhere to go and they can remember their moms, the poor women that have gone on. So the Laughter Lounge got behind me. I can't believe I managed to get in there. So I'm doing a script at the moment and Steve is helping me. And, you know, it's going to be really funny because I have brain radiation today. I have brain radiation on Thursday and then I'm standing on the show. So I'm going to be funny either way.
Emma Vicvahuna with Miriam O'Callaghan on Tuesday. Well, it seems there's still a very long way to go before we get the full facts and a resolution to the questions raised in the cervical screening controversy. The latest proposal comes following a meeting between Taoiseach Leo Varadkar and campaigner Vicky Phelan. He's asked a High Court judge to examine alternative mechanisms to compensation so that women can be spared the ordeal of going into court, as happened to Ruth Morrissey this week. The matter was discussed on The Gathering yesterday by RTÉ's Ingrid Miley and The Indo's John Downing.
No, I'm just intrigued about the fact that it could have been suggested that anyone was going to waive legal cases. For example, I did a quick tot. If you take Vicky Phelan's award of 2.5 million, and remember that's at the lower end because Emma Vicvahuna got 7.5 million, 221 cases at the front line of this, at a conservative tot of 221 times 2.5 million, Vicky's award, that comes to 552 million. Now, what lab or what state can write a blank cheque for that?
But if those women are wronged, I mean, in the individual cases.
No, I'm not disputing that they're wronged. And my heart goes out to those women. And it is absolutely shocking what has happened. But what I'm saying is that, for example, if you take the labs, they have shareholders. Their management has a duty of care to the shareholders. They were not going to sign off on giving away.
But they need a duty of care also to the people whose cervical smears are testing.
I'm not disputing that for a moment. What I'm saying is, how did anyone think this was going to get adjudicated without court cases, and how were representations made to that effect?
John Downing, on that point Ingrid makes?
I have seen and I have heard the figure in political circles of a ballpark of half a billion. Which is a considerable sum of money. And of course, when we talk about the American labs, we're also talking about their insurers, the ones who would ultimately pay, which makes it even more complicated again. It began 3 months ago as a scandal about women who were wronged and badly treated and all of that. It's rapidly becoming a scandal of government, broken government promises to dying women. The potential, the political potential from this is limitless.
How damaging do you think it is?
It could be catastrophic for Leo Varadkar, for Simon Harris and for the government.
From Today with Miriam O'Callaghan yesterday. Imelda May was Keelan Shanley's guest last Sunday morning. Here's a song she wrote about growing up in a loving family and a close community in Dublin's Liberties.
Once upon a time, a Dublin girl ran free down the cobblestones, round pubs and homes, as rich as she could be, swimming in the Irish Sea, climbing up Bray Head. Her lips were warmed with pots of tea, chips and buttered bread, fed love from mom and dad. They raised her up, they made her fly, they gave her roots and wings. As time moves on and years go by, she'll miss those simple things. She's the girl I used to be. The playgrounds all came down, and we mourned our factory. Times were tough, but I had enough. I had my family. Life kicked in with all its might, but my strong heart wouldn't. I got kicked around and broken down. I took all that I could take. Well, you raised me up, you made me fly, you gave me roots and wings. As time moves on, years go by, I miss those simple things.
Singer-songwriter Imelda May with her own song, The Girl I Used to Be. All week on Liveline, Joe Duffy and his listeners discussed the sordid underworld of child sexual abuse. On Monday, we heard from Tom, who looked at online images of child abuse pornography for 10 years before he got caught. He described how he drifted into it, and a word to the wise, this is not for sensitive ears.
It started about 9 or 10 years ago. I was in chat rooms, adult chat rooms, you know, and we'd just be chatting. Somebody would want to chat with you, and you chat, you talk about family, friends, etc. And then somebody just sort of said, look, here's a picture of my kids, you know. And it would be, initially they were clothed. And then later on, they became naked.
Anne-Marie Cunningham rang Joe. Her father, Bernard Cunningham, is serving time in Arbor Hill for abusing his four young daughters.
That phrase you use, he said to one of your sisters, go on, take me to court.
Take me to court and prove it.
And does that mean he was denying it all along?
Well, yeah, he denied it. Right to the end. I mean, we went through a 2-week trial. He kept putting the trial off. They wanted this information, that information. It took years. He was there and he was so stubborn. He was innocent and he told everyone he was innocent. And everyone believed him. And it was myself, my sisters, my mother in that courtroom against the world and against him. And putting our trust and our faith in the Irish justice system, please do the right thing here. And he put us through 2 weeks of hell. I had a day in the seat, and I went back to being a 5-year-old.
same as my other sisters did. And he sat there and he enjoyed every single minute of it. And right to the end, when that jury came back after 4 days, we had to wait. And they came back and it was unanimous guilty on every single count. And he screamed. He thought he was going to walk away. He had his jacket on him to walk out of the courtroom, to go home. No one actually knew he was in that courtroom, any of his friends or his family. It's beyond belief, like, how they act, how they live this life that no one knows about. So, yeah, he's doing his time. And that's how it is, like. And they just believe they're better than us. They believe that they can do that to children. They murder their childhood. They take away those little girls and boys' spirit. They break you down. They damage you for the rest of your life. You spend most of your life then trying to repair yourself.
Anne-Marie Cunningham. On Thursday, Mary rang Joe. She's the mother of a 19-year-old man convicted of possession of 6,000 images and 800 videos showing children being sexually abused. John is currently serving a 15-month sentence. Mary described that moment when at 7 in the morning, when the family was asleep in bed, Gardaí knocked on their door with a warrant.
They said, could they have a look at the laptops that were in the house? We said yes.
Yeah.
And they start searching and they said, is there another laptop? I said, yeah, in my son's room. So they went upstairs and got that, and we had to get our two children out of bed. And then they came down and they asked him a few questions, and he admitted everything there and then in front of us. And yeah, he collapsed himself, and it was an awful, terrible situation. And that's when our whole world crashed, and, you know, this existence came about then, you know. And they sat him down and questioned him, and we sat in another room, and then they just left. Only one guard turned around and said to us, get him to the doctor. And that was it. We didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know anything. We just sat there as if in complete and utter shock.
And your son, we'll call him John. You were there when the Gardaí said, John, we have a warrant here to search this house because we believe you've been accessing material related to child abuse, pornography.
But they didn't actually say, we believe you. He admitted it. He said it was me.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. They didn't know when they came to the house who was looking at the stuff. And he admitted it there and then. He said, it's me, you know. So.
And you say he showed other emotions then as well.
He collapsed. We tried to pick him up. The guards helped us, and he just said, he sat down, I want to talk. He said, I'll tell you everything, you know. He just admitted it there and then. Told him everything, you know.
And what age was he?
He had just turned 19 at that stage, but it had been since he was 16, it had been going on, you know.
And a complete and total shock to everyone in the family when this was revealed.
Oh, absolutely. He was, and he still is, to me, a great lad, a lovely lad to all of us. And this was totally out of character. We had no idea whatsoever.
Mary says she and her husband are full of shame. She says it's like living in a parallel universe, like Alice through the looking glass.
And he's still in prison?
Yeah.
And you visit him?
Yeah.
And what is that like?
It's a parallel universe, Joe. Something I never thought I'd have to do in my life. First few visits are, you know, heartbreaking. And now it's part of our routine now, you know. It's part of what we have to do as a family to get through this.
And what does he say?
Well, he knows. He's not saying, oh, I shouldn't be here or anything like that. He knows that he has to do the time for what he has done. This is a crime he committed that's punishable by law, and he knows that. The therapy, you know, he hasn't received anything in prison because there's nothing there, basically. You know, we're still waiting to hear if he can do anything like that to continue on with his therapy.
But he was engaged for the year before the court case.
Yeah, for the year and a half, yeah. Yeah, he was, yeah. You know, as I said, but this is something, Joe, that, you know, you'd be watchful for the rest of your life. This is a life sentence for all of us now. He has to watch himself. He has to know where he was in the first place that made him go down that road. And he has to identify the things that, maybe it's a depression, maybe it's something, maybe it's whatever he was feeling that made him do that. And he has to identify that. And we have to identify those things as well to watch him. But more so the onus is on him to watch himself. You know, that he will never go down that route again. But you see, you have people out there saying, when this all came out, kill him, you know, hang him up, torture him, do this to him, because he'll never change. But there has to be hope. There has to be a second chance in life. I know people have gone on to reoffend, but I can't talk about those people. I don't know them. Yeah. I don't know what's inside their minds. All I can do is try and do it for my family and for my son now, to see that he can move on, he can make a life for himself, he can live a proper, good life for himself after this.
All you now know about your son, and all you've learned through obviously being so proactive in a really salutary way, an important way in terms of learning more about this, do you think your son is a paedophile?
Oh, God. I don't know. Joe, you know, if you look that up in the dictionary, you know, like, he viewed images. He didn't touch anybody, but he viewed images. Mm-hmm. You know, a paedophile is somebody who has touched a child or in some certain way. So he's been branded as one regardless of whether I think he is or not.
Well, children's rights campaigner Christina Noble was listening to Mary, and she rang into Liveline.
Let me just tell you something, okay. Joe. First of all, that woman needs to recognise, if she is going to help her son, is that he is a paedophile, whether it's physical or getting sexual satisfaction from the film he watches. Mm-hmm. That is reality. I know, because I pick all the pieces up, over 1,430,000 kids. So let me just say this. Paedophiles are often very skilled at building a rapport with children. Mm-hmm. They know how to make a relationship with them, and they target the vulnerable ones, knowing how to make them feel special. They also target children they know they will be able to intimidate and control. Paedophiles are very often very nice, plausible people in their daily lives, mm-hmm. and can come across as outstanding people. This can make it very hard for children to speak out and be believed. My experience is that if abused children are listened to, believed, and given good quality therapeutic help, there is no reason why they will become abusers themselves.
And that was a worry expressed by Fiona on Monday.
They need help to recover what is a profound trauma.
Of course.
A trauma which is a violation of their dignity, of their bodies, and manipulation of their minds. These youngsters have been manipulated and assaulted by experts in the abuse of the most vulnerable.
Christina Noble heard on Liveline with Joe Duffy on Thursday. Well, Pope Francis's visit to Ireland later this month was yet again a hot topic across the airwaves this week, when Archbishop Diarmaid Martin said that the pontiff may not meet with survivors of abuse during his whistle-stop tour because time is so tight. Amnesty International's Colm O'Gorman, himself an abuse survivor, gave his reaction to Carol Coleman.
So it's not a yes and it's not a no, but you say the fact that nothing has been definitively scheduled yet basically indicates a lack of concern for the issue.
Well, I should first of all say that the idea, frankly, of yet another set piece where a pope visits a country that's been, because there aren't many countries that haven't been blighted by clerical sexual abuse within the Roman Catholic Church, and a private meeting is held with a select group of people behind closed doors, after which a pope comes out and expresses his sorrow at the trauma that they've experienced and at the crimes of priests and perhaps even the failures of bishops, is a little bit galling at this point. I mean, what I've been doing since 1998, when I launched my own legal action to try to force the Vatican to reveal what they knew about the rape and abuse of children, is I've just asked popes to tell the damn truth. And if Francis is going to come here in any way address the child abuse issue, he needs to take responsibility and own the established, proven fact of the cover-up of the rape and abuse of children at a global level, led by and facilitated by the Vatican. Anything less than that is just a nonsense. In a way, the idea that such a meeting might happen, the usual old meeting might happen, is a little bit wearing, a little bit galling. But what yesterday's developments show us, that isn't even being considered. That actually this issue is so far down the pecking order that it's of little regard to the Vatican or to those who've organised the visit. And this is a visit that, understandably, it's a huge occasion, has had a huge amount of effort and thought and work going into it. They've managed to organise their marketing, their merchandising, their licensing, distancing of the Pope's image and all the rest of it, but it would appear not a jot of attention has been paid to the idea of how are they going to address for the tens of thousands of people and families in this country who've been so traumatised and harmed by the rape and abuse of children and vulnerable adults that was facilitated by and then covered up by the church, including the Vatican. They haven't given a jot to how they're going to properly address that. I think that's disgraceful.
Colm O'Gorman, heard on Thursday's Morning Ireland. Over on Liveline, the so-called granny grant proposal from Minister Shane Ross and the Independent Alliance was getting a right bashing.
The granny grant, they're calling it, Shane Ross, the minister's big idea that every grandparent in the country who says, all you have to do is say, and it's independent of means and it's self-assessed, if you say you are minding your grandchild for at least 10 hours a week, you can get €1,000 every year. What do you think of that brilliant, brilliant idea, Anne Moore?
Absolutely ridiculous. Why? For example, Shane Ross was asked this morning, which of the grandparents, which of the four would get €1,000 if they share it? And he said all four of them.
Exactly.
That's €4,000 per child.
Well, if each grandparent says, I'm doing one day a week, that's if four of them are entitled to a grand
day
each.
And the parents have travelling time. Yeah, so it wouldn't be hard for a grandparent to mind the child for a full 10 hours in one day. And so if the four of them did it, they get 4,000. I actually think it's just a vote-getting thing for the grey vote or whatever. I think it's absolutely ridiculous.
So we don't know the number of grandparents. The figure is 70,000, they say, could be eligible for the grant. There are 65,000 children born in Ireland every year. So that means 325,000 children under five in Ireland at any given time
could possibly get the 4,000 per year.
And there is an incentive, by the way, given that parents with young children, regardless of where they are under enormous financial pressure with childcare. So why wouldn't you apply for the foreground, a grand each for each grandparent, and give it to your son or daughter to help them with the kid? There's a possibility of it costing $1.3 billion a year. $1.3 billion, not 71 million.
Do the country have $1.3 billion spare?
Are you joking me?
There you go.
Just one of the many irate callers about the granny grant to the Liveline with Joe Duffy on Wednesday. The final part of Brian O'Connell's series on our booming tourism industry and who really benefits from it this week focused on the destination town of Dingle in West Kerry, where the rise of short-term rentals like Airbnb is having a major impact on the local community. A great little earner for those with spare rooms to rent out, but for people like Deirdre Kane and her two children, it's a real problem.
We are living in a house for the last 10 years. Unfortunately, they went to NAMA and unfortunately, they wouldn't deal with us. They were sold on as a unit of six. So the six houses were sold on to Summerlets for 720,000.
So those six houses, which I'd imagine were housing families like you up to now, all of them are going to end up being short-term Summerlets, possibly Airbnb?
Airbnb, Summerlets, they're definitely, there's two of them already been converted into Summerlets. Like, I mean, I suppose my approach of it is, like, I have two young boys that have grown up in that house. They know no other home. Not only that, but they're in an all-Irish-speaking school. I'm very much, again, for the Irish language, trying to keep the Irish language alive. And I suppose I wanted my boys, I didn't want them to grow up inside in the centre of town. I wanted them to grow up in the countryside like myself.
You've obviously seen the impact of Airbnb on the ground here.
Yes, we have. I mean, in Dingle Town alone, even in the countryside, what's happening is a lot of people are being put out of their houses because long-term rentals are being put out because they're getting more money in the busy season. Long-term rentals, then they're not interested in giving it because they're getting more from that for the shorter season.
Where are people like yourself going to live?
People like ourselves, unfortunately, we have no idea right now. And that's the limbo that we're in right now. We don't know where we're going to go. Like, I suppose they're telling us that social housing out in Lisbole, which is what, nearly 14, 15 miles away from the school for my boys. Like, I mean, from Tralee back, it is impossible to get long-term accommodation.
Deirdre Kane. Well, for others, like tour guide Stephen McPhailamy, who owns a B&B in Dingle and an apartment on Main Street, this shortage of hotel beds and accommodation along the Wild Atlantic Way has been a godsend, and he's cashing in while the going's good.
In the summer, I was on the road, or I am on the road as a tour guide. My wife's doing a course at the minute in Dublin for 10 weeks, so I said to her, let's put it on Airbnb. There's no point in leaving it empty. To be honest, the price is so good from Airbnb that it made sense for us just to become a nomadic couple for 10 weeks.
Give us a sense of it.
Well, I rent the apartment for about 250 a week. I know that when I put it on Airbnb, I'll get 100 to 150 per night. So it suits my lifestyle. It might not suit everyone, but it's a very interesting scenario. There's very good returns there. It cost me about €50 to have the place cleaned, and I'm charging some nights 150. One or two nights I got 175, would you believe? I've had a relationship with Airbnb for 5 years. I actually like their model. I know there are lots of faults with it and there's lots of knock-ons. I like their maverick approach. From my experience, I see both sides of the story in Dingle. I hear of businesses, B&Bs, small factories, pubs, who find it hard to get staff simply because they can't find accommodation for the staff. At the same time, I meet loads of pub owners and B&B owners who also have a second property who are making good money on Airbnb. So I hear the pros and cons every day. But let's say somebody here who has two adult kids and they've moved off to Cork and New York, and they're probably not going to come back to Dingle full time in the near future. Well, there's two bedrooms there that they used to rent to the Irish student who would come here for like the rite of passage summer job. The person who owns that bedroom used to rent it for maybe 100 a week. Well, now you can get 100 a night.
Brian O'Connell reporting for Today with Miriam O'Callaghan. Well, Miriam also highlighted the problems the lack of broadband is having on rural businesses following the breakup of the consortium which had planned to supply high-speed broadband to 9 towns across the country. Adrian Weckler is technology editor of the Irish Independent.
Just one company with its hat in the ring right now, Enet. What does this mean for the bidding process? Is it at risk of collapsing?
It is at risk of collapsing, yes. It means that at the very least, it's going to be much more difficult for the only remaining company, Enet, to actually complete the tender in the time frame that the government wanted. Just to explain briefly, Enet had essentially teamed up with SSE, which owns Airtricity and is a big infrastructure player in the UK. SSE's role essentially was going to be to physically build the network, the broadband network, around rural Ireland. They have pulled out now, which means that Enet, which itself is good at managing networks, needs to find another massive infrastructure builder to take SSE's place. There are one or two companies that could do that. There are French companies and UK companies. Enet might even turn to Air, which can build networks itself, which would be a huge irony, seeing as Air pulled out of this national broadband plan tender a few months ago. So it means that at the very least, we're looking at a further delay in the national broadband plan. We also may be looking at a more expensive national broadband plan because the government now might be asked to pony up more money for the network building subsidy.
Eddie Walsh, you co-own Lissadell House with your wife, Constance. You've described, Eddie, the broadband in some rural areas like Sligo as prehistoric. Is it really that bad?
It certainly is, Miriam. If I want to use my iPad, I have to use my iPad in Dublin or in Naas. It's just a waste of time trying to do it in Lissadell. We have had a number of different service providers. Our current service provider is Air. The service is abysmal. It's really non-existent. And the point that I make is that if any other industry was providing a service that is so poor, that is so unacceptable, first of all, nobody should be paying them. But secondly, they should be accused of misrepresentation. Yeah, I looked at the Air ad this morning. Apparently, you could have up to 1,000 megabits. I don't even think we have 1 megabit. It is impossible. If I put in just whatever name I want to, for instance, I want to look at Live for wood products, and I put that in into the iPad, nothing comes up. Maybe after 10, 12 minutes, something will barely come. But I can't go and search at all. It's non-existent. We're turning down meetings, conferences, on the basis we have no broadband facility. We've been on to Air. We've made our complaints. We made our complaints to previous service providers. Each new service provider says, oh, no, no, we're far better. We can do this. But none of them are doing it. It's like getting in. The simple example that I use is, if I asked to take a taxi from outside and I walked out, got into the taxi, and they spend a minute or 2 minutes waiting to get going, they go 150 yards and stop, wait another minute or two before they take off, would you stay in that taxi? You certainly wouldn't. Yeah, there's something seriously wrong with broadband in rural areas.
Eddie Walsh and Adrian Weckler with Miriam O'Callaghan. Last week's documentary, The Last King of Ireland, featured Patsy Dan Rogers, the King of Tory Island. Patsy is a musician, artist and community leader, and he waited patiently over 2 years for a promised visit from the Prince of Wales to Tory off the coast of Donegal. Well, Prince Charles had been taught to paint by Derek Hill, an English artist who spent many years on the island. In the documentary, made by Patsy's longtime friend Kieran Devaney, the King takes us to visit Derek Hill's studio and to share his memories of the artist.
He wasn't long on the island until he reckons that the Tory Island rocks changed colours faster than any other rocks on any other island. He would come specially down from the hut on a Sunday night to be along with the Tory community to dance the Waves of Tory. Yes, yes. Now, welcome, Walter.
Inside the hut, it's as if Derek Hill now, had never left.
So, Prince Charles will sit here now. I will get down the photograph of Derek Hill and he will be able to paint a photograph here. This will be his little pantry. He used to fry there and cook mackerels that he loved over any other fish of the sea, mackerels, and he used to fry them there, yeah. And when we would look up from the village, it was absolutely delightful to see that he had that there was light in the hut here, you know. So that's our important visit to Derek Hill's hut. Now, thank you.
Narrated by Goretti Slaven, The Last King of Ireland was produced by Kieran Devaney and Tim Desmond. Well, I was listening to my colleague Ronan Kelly with Ray Darcy during the week, lamenting the end of the speaking clock service, which will be no more from the 27th of the month. Well, on Wednesday, Ray tracked down the first voice of the speaking clock, Frances McGrath from Mayo. Frances was a telephonist in the Dublin Exchange when she won the competition.
So there were four of you. Then you were asked probably to do specific things, were you?
Yes, to read out a script.
Yes, yes, yeah. And then you were chosen.
I was chosen, yes.
And the prize money was?
£50. A fortune then for a young girl.
Yeah, yeah. What age were you?
I was 23.
But it's a huge achievement because you were this sort of very public voice then at the age of 23.
Yes, I suppose so, yes. It was recorded in the Auntie Studios in the GPO.
Yes. And you went in, and can you remember, you have the script here, the original script, that's probably worth a lot of money. Give us an example of what you had to say then.
At the signal, it will be 1, 24 and 10 seconds. At the signal, it will be 1, 20 and 20 seconds. At the signal, it will be 1, 28 and 30 seconds.
But you didn't have to go through the full 24 hours.
I had 6 sheets to do.
Right.
And then they would pick the best one. They could mix them around at the time,
so they would use bits. Yeah, so they'd use the 1 and the 20 from somewhere else.
That's right, yes. Yeah.
Can you remember, was there a big announcement that you were... Because if this happened now, because this is a national thing, you would be on the Late Late Show, your picture would be everywhere, you know. Was there any of that?
Yes, there were a few pictures in the papers and things like that. It was very short, you know. And then Mr. Collins, Jerry Collins, I think his name was at the time, the minister, he opened it and he dialed the wrong number. He dialed the weather.
Right.
That caused a bit of consternation.
Fun and games as usual on The Ray Darcy Show. But I leave you now with tunes from the superband KGB, Paddy Keenan, Frankie Gavin and Dermot Byrne, who were Keelan Shanley's guests last Sunday. And they'll play live again with the RTÉ Concert Orchestra next Saturday night at the National Concert Hall. Well, Tomishik Togal Sus, Akbe Fiona Kelly, or Danta Unchachtin Chahuggin, Gajishin, Togabugay, August Gajishab Slon.
KGB, you're going to take it away again there, Frankie. What's our final song
today? Some title, isn't it? I mean, really.
I love it.
Between ourselves. I mean, come on. I'll tell you one place we won't be going. Anyway, we're going to be playing Dunphy's Hornpipe and the Belfast Hornpipe.
Tell us about that.
They're lovely tunes.